Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Andrew Price.
Welcome to Deep Cuts, the podcast where we pick a topic and walk you through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty, so you can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at your next forced social function. Today's topic is
Gerald Foose, a.k.a. The Voyeur.
Who is Gerald Foose? Well, he's a man who in the 1960s bought a motel with a strange purpose. He bought it so he could renovate a catwalk running along the ceilings of the rooms in order to observe the tenants without their knowledge. He spent the next 30 years consistently observing and cataloging the happenings of these people as they came and went, kept meticulous notes, and then one day he made a decision that would forever bring him out of the shadows and into the light. Act 1. Peeping Tom doesn't seem derogatory enough. What about Creepy Pete? Or how about Buckhead Gerald?
Yeah, Peeping Tom is like, that's some Back to the Future shit of just like the teenage rapscallion from down the street who certainly this is not appropriate or good, but it's just like, ah, little Jimmy, you Peeping Tom. That word just doesn't describe the sheer malevolence of what we're talking about here.
Have you ever seen someone on the bus and wondered about what their private life was like? Have you ever witnessed a chance encounter of two strangers and pondered what their future held? Well, Gerald Foose is a man haunted by these missed connections and tantalized by the ever-alluring call of strangers' bedrooms, though much so that he did something unthinkable. Gerald Foose bought Manor House Motel in Aurora, Colorado. He owned it for close to 30 years. He bought it in 1966 and began to transform this place of business into a private fishbowl where he could observe the human condition writ large. But Gerald Foose is not the only character in this story. You see, without a man called Gay Talese, we probably never would have even heard of Gerald. Gay Talese was born February 7th, 1932, and is one of the most acclaimed journalists of his era, having written infamous articles about Joe DiMaggio, Frank Sinatra, and was published by the New York Times, Esquire, and a variety of publishers. He cemented himself as a person who takes the written word seriously. In 1964, he published The Bridge, the building of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, a book that would cement him amongst the literary elite of journalism. In 1966, he would take a position writing full-time for Esquire, where he would pen the article Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, which is widely regarded as one of the most influential magazine articles of all time. Also, can we just talk for a second about how dope the title Frank Sinatra Has a Cold is?
It's a good title.
It's a really good title.
I've said it before on previous episodes. As a matter of fact, the dating ring episode. But I'm not a big reader of these sort of magazine feature stories. I'm not a follower. I'm not a reader. But it's an interesting art form. And every time I read one of them, I'm like, this is super well written, but it's not, in many ways, it's like an Arby's. It's like, you don't go there often. And you know, it's not something that enters your mind. You never think to go there, but when you do go there, you're like, this is some high quality shit.
I don't know that you and I have the same reactions to Arby's, but I appreciate that you are someone who is constantly attempting to work Arby's into casual conversation to get a rile out of me. That's what I respect about you, Andrew Price. In 1971, he published Honor Thy Father, a book about the travails of the Bonanno crime family. It was a bestseller and even eventually made into a TV movie. Possibly The most salacious book that Talese published was in 1981, titled Thy Neighbor's Wife. The book is an exploration of sexuality in America after World War II through the 1970s. In prep for the book, Talese lived at a clothing-optional sandstone retreat, where he engaged in orgies, debauchery, and sexual exploration. So I feel like we should kind of talk a little bit about gay Talese as a guy for a minute.
Is there anything, it's interesting, is there any, other than like comic book artist or writer, or like maybe like photographer, maybe even like architect, this is the short list of jobs in addition to journalists that they have such a pervasive effect on culture, and yet you have no idea who they are.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate you throwing comic book person in there. I don't know that that's true, but I appreciate you putting that in there.
Maybe urban design,
somebody who designs like bus routes or like, you know, turning lanes, like thing, parking lot, you know, the person who designs how the parking lines go in a parking lot, like that affects everybody so much. And like
city and infrastructure planners.
Yeah, totally.
There's a great book on city infrastructure called The Works, which is just it's a coffee table book that shows you how everything in large cities works and how it's built, like how streetlights function with the sensors underneath the street and how they're implanted and stuff. It's very, very, very fascinating book.
Hmm. That sounds right up my alley. I have no knowledge of that, but that sounds like something I would enjoy reading.
Yeah, it's called The Works.
So Gay Talese is this dude who is, as you can tell from the kind of stuff that we've been listing off, these many accolades, he straddles the world between hard-nosed traditional journalist and kind of the burgeoning literary article writer type journalist, where it's, you know, I think he as a guy views himself more as like the beat reporter out on the street, see, asking hard questions. But his execution and his fan base is probably more towards what you would think of as like the kind of East Coast elite, right? He lives in a brownstone in New York. His dad was a tailor, so he wears these really nice suits all the time. He's the type of guy that like, even in the 1980s, was wearing like well-tailored suits and like 1950s fedoras, but like not in a cringy way, like in a, wow, that guy's got money way.
He looks good in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What a name too. That name is just perfect for that person.
I'm sure it must have been hard growing up with that first name.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, I wasn't even talking about that. Like obviously there's like a stigma of like making fun of, you know, like the fucking meet the parents.
Yeah.
Gaylord Fokker joke or whatever. Hopefully we've somewhat moved past that now, but yeah, in the 80s. He's probably wasn't, or not even in the 80s, in the 40s when he was a kid, probably wasn't that was probably fine too, because it meant something different back then. Yeah, it was probably in the 70s and 80s where he was getting the hardest of it.
Yeah, so he's this kind of guy who, you know, basically builds this world for himself, this career, being a simultaneous investigative reporter and also carving out this very commercial niche of salacious topics. Or, you know, I mean, look at the trajectory, right? He starts writing about infrastructure and then gets involved with celebrities and then quickly figures out, oh, the way to make money is you write about sex and crime. Okay, I'm gonna write a book about the mob and then I'm gonna write a book about sex. And in the kind of heyday of those journalistic kind of deep dive nonfiction books, it serves him very well. He makes a lot of money.
He was like the one man vice of the 80s.
Yeah, totally. It's a very good point. Yeah, like he totally could have been, if there was a vice in 1984 or whatever, Gay Talese is the person you would have hired to like run it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he really, you know, most of his books were kind of in a literary academia, people who like these types of works way prior to Thy Neighbor's Wife and Honor Thy Father. Those are the two books that really kind of like burst him out onto a mainstream kind of level of acceptance. And he did the late night circuit for Thy Neighbor's Wife, and he did the daytime circuit for Thy Neighbor's Wife, and like was on TV all the time talking about, like, you know, either the Bonanno crime family or, you know, what it was like living in this basically swingers resort for a long time. And he was married at that point and, like, basically, you know, low key had an agreement with his wife where he was just like, I'm going to go do this stuff because I have to for the book. And she was like, all right.
That's another interesting thing as well. This, I mean, maybe this still exists, but I don't see it that much. But this idea of, especially in the, you know, the 60s and the 70s, this idea of these journalists who sort of like their own personalities were as interwoven in the stories that they told as the stories, you know, your, you know, gonzo journalism, your Hunter S. Thompson's, where they're just like, you know, they're not somebody going around just like reporting on something. They're like in it, like fully. They've yeah. immersed themselves in the lifestyle.
Yeah, completely.
And their work almost becomes like autobiographical, like they've made themselves a character in their story.
Yes. Yeah. And very intentionally so. Like, we're going to talk about it a lot over the course of this episode, but Gay Talese seems like somebody who very quickly became media savvy and figured out that writing is only half the battle. Writing is only 50% of what you need to do in order to be a successful person in America and have longevity and be able to support yourself off of your work, right? Like, I mean, just 30,000 foot view. The dude went from writing about a bridge to very quickly being like, ah, yes, Frank Sinatra. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. He very quickly was just like, where is the money? How am I going to continue to do this? Okay, cool. I'll go over there. And that's not a bad thing. That's just somebody reading the room and having specific desires for where they want their career to go, right?
I did the bridge thing. Bridge thing was nice. People liked the bridge thing. Maybe not such enthusiasm about the bridge thing. Like, maybe people aren't like super into bridges. Like, there's certain people that are super into bridges, but like, for the most part, I feel like most of us, we drive over them. It's like, oh, I got over that body of water. And then we're done. We wash our hands of the bridge. Maybe I'm gonna move on to something that is a little bit more resonant with the greater population.
In 1979, prior to Thy Neighbor's Wife release, Talese optioned the rights to make a film off of it for $2.5 million. At the time, this was the largest single payment for the rights to a film adaptation of a book ever. In 1987. Gay Talese received a letter from a man claiming to have something that might interest him. This man was Gerald Foose. He explained to Talese how he renovated a motel to have a high-pitched roof, how he had built an observation platform, and how he had done all of this with the assistance and permission of his wife. Gay Talese had to see it for himself.
GG Foose, you're doing it wrong, man. You don't just go out there and tell people what you're doing. If you've got a secret observation dungeon, keep that shit under wraps, buddy. H.H. Holmes, he had a murder hotel and he never told anybody about that shit, and he's fine, he's still alive to this day.
The two men kept in close contact for 30 years. They corresponded often, with Gerald Foose eventually showing Gay Talese all of his meticulously typed notes. Gerald did all of this under the condition that Gay would not go public and would not reveal his identity. However, in the mid-2010s, he had a change of heart. The two men, nearing their 80s at this point, didn't want all of this work to be lost. They wanted people to know what happened. And so, Gerald agreed to let Gay use his name and write about him for The New Yorker.
I mean, joking aside of what I just said, like what? I have my thoughts, obviously. But what compels somebody? I mean, this is obviously, I mean, maybe it was a different time. And so maybe it wasn't, because this is like a dark secret. This is like, you are committing so many crimes. So maybe it was just slightly thought of differently back then, where he really could convince himself that it was some kind of observational experiment or something like that. But what convinces somebody to go tell somebody about this? Like, just go admit to anybody about these horrible crimes and then just be like, but don't tell anyone though. Our secret, pinky swear, buddy boy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot to unpack there, and I'm a little reticent to start unpacking who Gerald Foos is underneath the surface of just like, fuck this guy, he's a pervert, until we get a little further in the story, because there are some twists and turns that I want to discuss those as they're happening. But I think if you think about it from a perspective of that the human condition is largely built around communication, that it kind of makes sense. Like, it doesn't on one level, I don't really understand why you would tell anyone, but it's kind of the same thing of like why serial killers leave maps to their victims, and why, you know, at the end of their lives, people who've committed these horrible atrocities confess, and, you know, like the woman who got Emmett Till killed, like, on her deathbed, she was like, I lied. He didn't actually whistle at me. That poor boy got fucking lynched for no reason. And it's just like, there's a catharsis, and there's a desire to be seen and forgiven and be wiped clean through the mirror of other people, right?
Yeah, or maybe not even necessarily forgiven, but just like, whether you're forgiven or not, whether or not you get the people react by fucking murdering you in the streets, mob style. It's just like getting that weight off this thing that's just like such a dark secret that you obviously would not want to tell anybody if you did it for fear of legal retribution and just being seen as a monster. But that, like, it's so weighs down on you over the years that relieving that pressure in any way is a better alternative.
What would you do if you, like, if instead of Gay Talese, Gerald Foos reached out to us to do a deep dive episode of Deep Cuts about thing? Like, what would your reaction be?
I would immediately report it to the police. Like, well, I mean, that I mean, it probably wouldn't even get that far, because, I mean, in all honesty, if somebody reached out to me with like that, I wouldn't go. Like, I'd be like, fuck that. I'm not going to your weird fucking secret dungeon and learning your dark secrets. That just seems like I'm going to get murdered. But if I did go and saw that, I would immediately report it to the police. Like, of course. I'd just be like, have a good day, man. See ya in the funny papers. And then go out and then just immediately call the police.
Yeah. It's also hard not to be intrigued by it, though. Like, I understand why this person's very compelling narrative has captured so many people's imaginations, right? Like, I don't quite know what to classify it as, but, like, this dude commits sex crimes, you know? Like, I don't know how to classify watching other people fuck without their knowledge under the pretense that you're not watching them, but that's like a sex crime. I don't know what it's called, but that's fucked up.
Well, I mean, there's something deeper there, but I mean, first and foremost is, I think, like, voyeurism, like unconsenting voyeurism is illegal, I'm pretty sure. So that's the crime right there, first and foremost. And then, there's, you know, I'm sure that you could classify that in some way. If you're in your own home and you're doing that and somebody spies on you, then that's illegal, but it's, you know, it's just somebody spying on you. But if they invite you into their facility under the pretense that you'll have privacy, and then they spy on you, so you're being viewed without your consent in a place where the person invited you into and gave you the illusion of privacy, then, yeah, it's like...
ocular rape.
Yeah, something. I was trying to think of, like, privacy rape or something. I don't know. Yeah, something like that. For sure.
Like, it's really fucked up. Like, it's real. Yeah, I'm not about it. But we're gonna talk a lot more about this in a minute. I think it's fair that we can go to an act break right here and pick up this discussion very shortly. Act two. The New Yorker is classy, right? So Gay Talese and Gerald Foos start the process of making the years of files into a New Yorker piece, and then a novel pitch is also created and sold. Some of the stuff that Gerald says, quite frankly, just can't be substantiated. He's an unreliable narrator at best. One of the fact checkers responsible for collating and investigating many of Gerald Foose's more outlandish claims, uncovers that Gerald bought the Manor Hotel in 1969. Yet all of his records say 1966.
Not as nice.
So, not as nice. But it's the thing
just,
about
that's just an awkward, like, what are you even doing there?
Well, the thing is, it's not even just like, it's not just that, like, oh, he had like a line item spreadsheet where it just like listed 1969 at the top and he just like flipped it to make it 1966. Like, no, it's like, it's a journal where he refers to himself in the third person, where there are daily entries of him observing people, and each entry starts with a date and a time. You know, 1966, August 12th, 2:22 p.m. The voyeur watched this person go into this thing. It's really weird. He always refers to himself as in third person as the voyeur in these journals. And I just don't buy for a second that he wrote three solid years of journals where he got all of the dates wrong, that he owned this hotel for 3 years that he never owned it for. Like, I just don't buy that.
I mean, have you looked at the Andrew WK and Steve Mike information site?
No shit, right? No shit. Okay. Gerald Foose is the creepy, perverted Andrew WK from the 1960s. Except he only sings songs about motels and voyeurism.
Yeah. We watch what
who's gonna check in? Who's gonna check in? Who? We're gonna check in. We're gonna check in. Yeah.
Let's get some peeping started. Now we're gonna see you and you're gonna be fucking hard.
He shows up to the interview with Gay Talese and he's just dressed in a all white with a giant, like, long-haired wig like Andrew WK.
maybe the voyeur is Andrew WK.
Maybe that's why the voyeur finally came out, you know? Yeah. It was like, these are all the things because Andrew WK is going to steal my shtick. I can feel it. He's stolen my look.
Like, this son of a bitch. He dresses exactly like me. How did he know?
Yeah. So over the course of kind of selling this pitch for a novel, selling this New Yorker piece, and putting this all together as kind of a package deal, Gay Talese and Gerald Foose partner with some documentary filmmakers who are basically going to document this whole process, and they're going to make a documentary.
Can you believe, like, being business partners with just, like, the H.H. Holmes of the 60s? Like, I mean, that's a little strong. He didn't murder anybody. But, like, this criminal, like, sex pervert, crazy person. And you're just going to, like, Netflix pitch meetings and being like, yeah, this is my buddy Gerald. Do we have the pitch for you? Like, and just being in those meetings, the Netflix executives just being like, oh, yes, well, of course, thank you, Mr. Talese and Mr. Foose. Really loved your pitch. Thought it was really impassioned. I admire the work that you've done with jerking off to unsuspecting couples. And we'll call you. We'll have our people call you.
Yeah, it's just so, I don't know. It's just so unthinkable. But it also,
we'll give you a stand-up special right after Dave Chappelle's new one.
Yeah. Let's watch this trailer for the documentary and then talk about the documentary just a little bit.
Since I first saw you, I couldn't pull myself away.
It's opening with the silent photos and footage of the motel and people driving around this town, and a door is opening. And
I received this letter in 1980 from a man named Gerald Foose, who decided he wanted to buy a motel for the express purpose of using it to watch everything that was being done in private.
It had a high-pitched roof. That's where I would build my observation platform. They couldn't hear me. They couldn't see me. That was exactly what I wanted.
I'm writing a story about him for The New Yorker. I'm a natural person to write about a voyeur because as a writer, I'm a voyeur myself.
Nobody ever will be able to do what I did.
I mean, Foos is really disturbed, a sociopath who just needed the attention.
I spent more than 25 years waiting to bring his story and him as a person into the public eye.
If I knew what I was going to feel, I'd have never done this.
Gerald Foos and I have a deal. That is, for me to tell the truth and him to live with it. Suddenly, this guy is forgetting what we've agreed to.
I think Gay and I are going to have a real problem.
What the hell does he think this is? Some kind of goddamn game?
They're trying to expose you as a hypocrite.
How do you know what they're thinking?
So weird.
The way people are.
If I had known this was a horrible crime, it's unforgivable, I would have never done this. Utterly riveting.
So
even Mothman is just like, we gonna actually this is really ethically shady. I can't be involved in this. See you guys later.
The Mothman is like, we gonna fuck in parentheses with full consent, not go violating anyone's boundaries. We definitely want everyone to be comfortable and have a good feeling and be safe at all times and definitely not feel violated.
I feel like I have to come forward and really be the speak truth to power for the we gonna fuck community and really and really just
the WGFC.
Yeah,
the we gonna fuck community,
the association of the WGFC, as and me as a representative of coming forward to distance ourselves from Gerald Foos and state that all we gonna fuck activities are fully consensual. We do not condone the unwitting voyeurism. If you want me to watch you fuck, I'll watch you fuck.
But I will be there the whole time, just letting you know I'm over here.
Yeah.
I am in the room. I am watching you. And I am consenting to watch you as long as you are consenting to have me watch you.
And as an extra measure to show that the We Gonna Fuck Association is an ally, we are going to start implementing a consent contract into all of our fucking activities. You have to verbally agree before, during, and after each We Gonna Fuck session. And we will also be donating to the organization of choice for the victims associated with the unfortunate actions of Mr. Foos. Thank you very much. And also, all the journalists in this press pit, We go
fuck. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Let's talk about this documentary a little bit and also talk about the fact that it's so clear that Gay Talese is the one putting this all together. You know, like there's a couple points in the documentary. We'll talk more about, you know, Gerald Foos and his moral reprehensibleness. But there's a couple points where Gay Talese is very media savvy and very kind of on point. And you heard it in that trailer. There's a point where one of the documentarians is interviewing them and they ask Gerald Foos a question about something that he had been previously pissed off at Gay Talese for. And they're asking him that with Gay Talese in the room to try and get a softer answer to make him look, you know, a little bit wishy-washy, like he's not committed to his ideals. And Gay Talese knows that that's exactly what's happening and gets really pissed off and is like, this isn't ethical journalism. You're setting this up to make him look a certain way. And Gerald Foos has no idea what's going on. He doesn't get it. He's an 80-year-old man who's just like, I've been hanging out with these documentary guys and they're like my friends.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the weirdest setups for a documentary I've ever seen, ever. It's like, you've got like, it's funny because I talked to I don't know if I'll say both. So either you heard it in one of the QAnon episodes or it was part of an interview I did for the QAnon episodes that didn't make it into the show. But I talked to Will Sommer, the journalist, about, I basically asked him, like, what is it like to reach out to these figures, these perpetrators of these crimes, or just these people that are involved in these things like the QAnon movement or whatever it is, and like get them to agree to be in your article or do an interview with you or be in, you know, a video that you're doing or whatever. And, you know, in this dynamic where you're not necessarily you're trying to be objective, but you're certainly not painting it in a positive light. And there's no way that this person can think that them participating in this thing is going to work out well for them. You know, what is it like to do that, to get these to agree, get these people to agree to be in your thing, knowing that it's like about them and in, you know, painting it in somewhat of a negative light? Because that just has always fascinated me. Like, how do they get all those people to be in the QAnon documentary and for all those people to be like, nope, this isn't going to in any way turn out bad for me. And this is the weirdest, craziest version of it of all time. Because you have this story about this guy who did this horrible thing that was like millions of crimes. There's like so many crimes involved in what he did. And then like there's a documentary about it. So, you know, similar to the Jinx, like you could compare it, I think, most closely to the Jinx, like this true crime documentary about this guy and a bunch of the things that he may or may not have done. And he's in it and he's involved in it. But he's like, you know, he's definitely adversarial within the documentary, like the filmmaker who made the Jinx. He forms this relationship with them, but their relationship is adversarial. He agrees to talk sometimes, but then sometimes he's hiding from him and the guy's trying to track him down. And eventually he ends up kind of like accidentally incriminating himself with this thing where he goes into the bathroom with his wire still on and like
spoilers.
Yeah. Well, it's like national news now. He got convicted based solely on that piece of evidence. So I feel like if you look at the news, you've heard this, but
spoilers.
But this is like, this isn't just like, oh, we're this guy is the subject of our documentary. Like, this guy is like a producer. Like, he's like involved in the production of it. It's so weird. All these people are just like, hey, EP Gerald Foos. Like, what do you think about this setup here? You think the lighting looks good? Also, you're a maniac. Like, it's so fucking insane.
Yeah. The stuff that I feel like we should talk about with him is kind of like his character, his reactions to some of these things, and then also the things that he admits to, like, from the jump. So basically, in the documentary, it's detailed, and in the article, and in the novel, to differing levels of detail. It's kind of explained that, you know, Gerald Foos and his first wife bought this hotel. He built this observation platform. He watched copious amounts of people having sex. He also would just spend all night up there and just watch people like hanging out and watching TV. And his first wife would come and bring him sandwiches at like 2 a.m. and shit because he wouldn't leave. And like in the documentary, he's like, well, you know, you can only jerk off like so many times. And then you just like sit up there and watch people. And like he has this story of when he was a kid, his aunt, who had very large breasts, was changing and he saw her through a window and it changed his life. And he was just like, A, it defined his sexuality. He was really obsessed with big breasts from that point on, and also with voyeurism. And also that aunt was a collector. She collected quilts and stuff, I think. And so he started collecting baseball cards and sports paraphernalia and all these other kind of like strange things. So when they're in their house in Colorado in the documentary, like his whole basement is just stuff. It's just like millions of dollars of stuff. And he claims like, oh yeah, this is a Mickey Mantle rookie card. It's worth $1 million. And it's like, is it really? I can see that it's graded at a 5.0.
You're crawling around in fucking vents jerking off to people. Like,
yeah.
I'm gonna take this to get graded by a real professional.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, you know, he admits to, you know, seeing all these sex acts, observing all these people, sometimes for months, because he would get invested in their lives, and then he would, like, decrease their rent at the motel to keep them at the motel so he could keep watching them. Which, again, that's not like a crime that's on the books, but that feels like a crime. That feels like some sort of, like, weird indentured jerkitude or something. Like, I don't know.
First of all, love indentured jerkitude. But he was just creating the proto Big Brother, baby. He was right there in the beginning. He was grassroots, but he was doing it before anybody else was doing it. He envisioned our future voyeuristic reality television society, and he was like, that's where we're going. I'm going to create it right here in this hotel.
It's true. Yeah, it's really fucked up. Yeah. And that's the other thing that's really interesting about it is that he never tried to tape anybody. It was always just him watching them and then writing these journal entries, which is so interesting because you would think that that type of person would be, as soon as like personal camcorders came on the market or like 16 millimeter film cameras came on the market, he would be like, I must tape the people having the sex.
Yeah, he could have started up a whole bootleg fucking underground market.
Ugh, that's horrible.
Oh, wait, did you hear that? I thought there was something, like a sound that was coming from
ceiling. That sounds like a really sad, balding fat man committing crimes in the ceiling above us.
Maybe I was just imagining it. All right. Fuck.
So
that's why he finally told somebody. He's like, I saw Mothman. I can't keep this a secret anymore. Like I saw Mothman in an orgy with like 20 people.
So the thing that I feel like, you know, the stuff that we've been talking about is they are crimes, but they're not like grade A crimes, right? They're like,
these are RC Cola crimes.
Exactly. But at one point in the documentary,
these are best choice crimes.
Kroger brand crimes.
Yeah.
At one point in the documentary though, Gerald Foos is telling a story about how he was renting out a room to a drug dealer, you know, a small-time local drug dealer. And Gerald Foos's son was addicted to opioids at that point, and it, like, sent Gerald Foos off the deep end. And so when that drug dealer, who was staying in the room with another woman who was helping him deal drugs, left for the day, Gerald Foos went into the room, unscrewed a vent, took out all the drugs, and flushed them.
He went full Leo DiCaprio in Growing Pains on him?
He went full Gerald Floosh. That doesn't really work. That doesn't really work. But he went in there and he flushed all of these drugs and then screwed the vent back on, went back up into the observation deck. And that night when the drug dealer and this female companion came home, the drug dealer went to go check the stash and it wasn't there. And he's like, it was you. You took the drugs. You sold the drugs. You stole the drugs. Fuck you. And he beat that woman to death.
Oh, my God.
He beat her
Jesus
to death.
Jesus Christ.
He beat her to death. And Gerald Foos, A, was responsible, but B, watched it happen the whole time and never went down there to stop her. He never got out of his fucking pervert jerk-off nest and went down and just knocked on the door of the apartment to get the dude to not strangle this woman. There was a situation that Gerald directly caused.
Yeah, and that's just like, that's true, uncut voyeurism. To just like, you're watching this thing, you really are just a fly on the wall, you do not intervene in whatever way. Well, you kind of do because you caused this, but just to be just like, that's got to take some massive disassociation to be like that much of a voyeur that you really are just like viewing it like it's a show on TV and you are not even going to like stop a murder from happening.
So then basically the guy throws the woman on the floor and Gerald Foos claims that he saw her chest moving up and down. He claims that he thought she was alive. I don't believe that for a second, but that's what he claims in the documentary. He also, at multiple points in the documentary, talks about how, well, the statute of limitations on these things has probably run out. Like, we're pretty sure that the statute of limitations has run out, like, for multiple things. So he's very, like, obviously aware of, A, he's an unreliable narrator, B, he's aware that these are crimes, and C, is somebody who's trying to be... He's trying to sell a sensational story while also not implicating himself on something that is like going to be a guaranteed ticket to the fucking electrical chair.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Which is like, why? Like, why? This is so, like, why would you even risk towing that line? Like, to come out and, Oh my God! It's like it's
but
like.
Why would you do the other stuff first? Why would you murder someone first?
Yeah, but I'm like, then, I'm talking about from the perspective of like somebody who has done these things. Like there, you know, there's that's it's a given that you know murdering people is bad, but there are still serial killers that do it and you know don't care. But in that in those shoes, like is getting famous really worth like the gray area of like. I might say something that's going to get me sent to prison forever.
Well, that's what's even crazier about it, right? So he witnesses this woman being brutally attacked. He says he thinks she survives, but then he goes back to his like management bungalow or whatever at the motel and doesn't call the cops. He doesn't call for help.
Yeah.
So he goes to sleep, gets up the next morning, and there's a knock on his door, and it's one of his employees, a maid, who has found this woman dead in the apartment and is like, yo, Mr. Gerald, like, there's a woman dead. And he has to then pretend that he doesn't know what just happened.
Oh, my stars and garters, a murdered woman. I've just received the shock of my life. I have never even heard about a dead woman. I didn't even know women could die.
They're so innocent and beautiful. I assumed they just phased out of existence. Like a very sexy Obi-Wan.
I thought that any woman who passed from this mortal coil just decided that her time was up and then just faded, the cross-faded to a plate shot of an empty room.
So then the cops come and Gerald Foos, this piece of shit, has to like, I don't know what happened here. And this is where things get even crazier.
I didn't even know that women existed. I thought that men just reproduced by budding.
So then what's even crazier is like as this goes on and his unreliable narratorness unfurls and these dates get proven to be wrong, Gay Talese tries to verify that there was a dead body at the motel that he owned. Because there's a date. There's a journal entry that says this is when it happened and a date. And he's like, okay, I know the town, I know the location, and I know the day. I should be able to look in police records and find a newspaper or a police report or some sort of documentation that this woman was beat to death. Nope. He didn't find anything, which again is like, is Gerald Foos lying about this? Did it happen a year later, 3 years later, 2 years later? Did it happen at all? Like, what the fuck is happening here?
It could also have just been, you know, I'm going out on a limb here, and I don't want to get canceled for saying this, but you have a
famous
drug...
Famous last words.
You have a drug famous dealer. You have a drug dealer in a motel room with a woman. She's likely a sex worker, and even if she's not, even if she's just like a junkie or whatever, that, you know, there are people who are regarded as the quote-unquote less dead, which are, you know, sex workers, drug addicts, people of color, particularly back in those days where, like, the police just did not give a fuck. And so there's a possibility that they just didn't file a report on it because they just didn't care because it was just some, you know, junkie dead in a hotel room or whatever, or motel room.
Side note, The Lesser Dead is a good title for a 1960s procedural about a private detective who goes around trying to locate dead bodies of the types of, in air quotes, lower class people that are dead through sex trade and drug addiction. Just saying.
Powerful, powerful log line.
Add it to the list. That pilot will never get written.
Nope. It's enjoyful to just think about it. Just imagine it being written.
Added it. I literally added it to my list. That will never get written. So anyway, you know, those are the kind of like the bullet points of he sees all of this sex and he documents all of it. He sees all of these kind of lower tiered crimes and he documents it. And then he sees this. He causes a murder. He murders someone and documents it.
Murder somebody by voyeurism. Murder by anonymity.
And so he owns this place for 30 years, right? He comes and goes. He's watching all of these people. And then he meets Gay Talese. They start writing this book together. They don't write together. Gay Talese writes it. But the interesting thing is, like, why would
just,
you come
But just
forward?
Imagine that, though. Imagine they're in the office. Gerald Foos is sitting on the couch. He's tossing the football up and down. He's tossing the crumpled up papers into the little basketball hoop. And Gay is sitting at the typewriter. He's typing up. And Gerald's like, all right, so what if the lady survived? How's that sound? How's that feel? And Gay's like, you know what bumps me about that though? You know what bumps me is it's not believable because she did die and you did murder her by not notifying the authorities or intervening or in any way helping the situation. That's the thing that bumps me about it. I feel like
Should we take it to the room? Yeah, let's take it to the room. They like get up, you know, they're casually having small talk, walking down the clean, white, pristine hallways of a Culver City studio back lot. They open a door and there's a room where it's 12 writers, 6 on one side, 6 on the other, all wearing the exact same clothes. And the 6 writers on the right are they all have Gerald Foos's face. And all 6 writers on the left all have Gay Talese's face. And they're like, so we're thinking about not killing the drug dealer's female companion at the end of chapter 30. What do you guys think? And all of the Gerald Foos's goes, yeah, she should definitely live. Definitely live. Definitely live. Because, you know, I'm pretty sure the statute of limitations is not run out on that. And then the Gay Talese's on the other side are like, yeah, but you know what I'm bumping on? I'm just bumping on... Who's going to believe that? Because that's not what happened.
And she did die, and you murdered her. And, you know, this is real journalism.
And then they all just look at each other, and then they all just look at the camera at us.
And then Mothman comes in and goes, we go fuck.
And then it's all of the Gay Talese's having sex with each other while all the Gerald Foos's sit back and watch.
Now, is that opens up an interesting question, though, because if you're in a room and you are in the middle of the room and you are jerking off by yourself, and then there's like 10 Gerald Foos's sitting in the corners of the room watching you, is that considered an orgy?
I don't think so.
Because they're engaging in a sex act. That's voyeurism is a fetish.
Yeah, and it's part of voyeurism participation, yeah. But I don't think it's an orgy just because I think that it actually has a more precise name. I believe the name of that is the Foos Motel.
Yeah.
So.
You guys want to run a Foos Motel?
Yeah, I could go for a Foos Motel. Let's do it. But they're writing all of this stuff, and the chronology of things that happen is they start filming the documentary, they sell the project through Gay Talese's book agent. Then they set up this short, condensed version of the book to be serialized in The New Yorker. It'll be published in The New Yorker. And then out of that will spin the full novel, which was, I don't remember who published it, but it was a Big Five publisher. It was fucking Random House or Penguin or, you know, whoever.
This book is published by really Random House.
So, but the interesting thing to me is like the whole third act of the documentary is kind of chronicling the fallout of everything that's happening. And when the New Yorker article comes out, Gerald Foos gets really, really pissed off at Gay Talese because Gay Talese attempts to provide insight into why would someone come forward? Why would someone corroborate and cooperate in a book project about their own crimes, essentially? And Gay Talese offers the supposition that maybe the reason why Gerald Foos is cooperating is that he wants the notoriety to sell his baseball card collection. He has cards that are worth $1 million. And so maybe the attention brought on him by this documentary, short, you know, fiction, nonfiction, and book project will allow those to sell for exorbitant amounts of money.
Oh my God, he was like an early Logan Paul.
Yeah.
Logan Paul, he does this thing in Japan where he records the hanging body in Suicide Forest, and it's a huge controversy. He gets a massive amount of backlash. Then he waits a little bit, and then he's like, gonna sell some Pokemon card NFTs, motherfucker.
So there's a good chunk of the third act of the movie where it's just like Gerald Foose being irate about that specific detail, about Gay Talese referring to him as like somebody A, who has money, and B, who is trying to sell baseball cards. He's not pissed off that he's like he's a fucking sex criminal. He's pissed off about the fact that Gay Talese told people he has a lot of money in baseball cards, which is such a strange character detail. It's so weird. He also has this like bizarre moral piety where when the news starts getting out, he doesn't react in a way that you would anticipate. It's almost like he's so close to the 30 years of sex crimes that he has stopped seeing them as sex crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets really pissed when local news people are like, he's a fucking pervert. Look what he did. And he's like, I'm not a fucking pervert. And you're like, ah, you are. Like, literally. And it's funny because his second wife, who also has condoned all of this, which is like, how do you find two women who will put up with that? Jesus. Honey,
there's plenty
I love
of,
you.
There's plenty of fish in the sea, but there's only two fish in the sea who will be fine with you jerking off on other fish without their knowledge.
Fucking surreal. But she like at multiple points has to be like, Gerald, what are you talking about? You are a pervert. Like, what did you think was gonna happen? Why are you pissed off at this?
I thought you knew that. He's like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm not a pervert. I mean, you were married to me. It's like, yeah, I have a pervert fetish. I thought I was very clear about this. I get off on being married to just a sociopath who is into depraved acts of sexual exploitation. Like, it's the only way I can get off is if I know my husband is off somewhere in this world just doing horrible, depraved crimes against people without them knowing it. Like, we that's what my Tinder profile said. That was my whole pitch.
It's so fucking weird to me. It's so weird to me.
I also just love the idea. The idea is funny to me of like Gerald Foose just kind of being like, yeah, you know, I'm hanging out with my boy Gay. We're buddies. I told him about my whole thing and he, you know, I was a little scared to tell him at first. I was a little nervous because, you know, it's an acquired taste to, you know, learn about this. Like, you never know how someone's going to react to you telling them that you have a jerk off mind rape dungeon. But he seemed okay with it. He seemed like he was down and we started hanging out more and he wanted to talk about it. We wanted to write this book about it. And, you know, he's my buddy. He's like my best friend. I'm going to just say that. He's my best friend. And then Gay is over here just like, yeah. So, you know, I'm just curious, you know, in observing my subject, the voyeur, what drives a maniac sociopath to admit his crimes to a journalist? And Gerald's just like, what the fuck, man? I thought we were cool. I thought we were buddies. And he's like, what? No, I mean,
you
no,
joke.
Of course.
You joke, but he almost literally says that. Like, there's a part in the documentary where he's talking to the documentary film crew about how pissed off he is at Gay Talese. And he's like, you know, we don't really have friends. Like, me and my wife, we don't really have friends. And like, she's in the corner cooking or something. And she's like, you don't have friends.
Oh, got him. Hashtag dunk.
And he's like, you know, I don't really have friends. You know, I don't really care about anybody. I don't really go anywhere. I just like being in my house. I like being around my baseball cards. I like my wife. She's a good person. And, you know, I just like, you know, doing my own thing. And I really trusted Gay. And he really betrayed me when he talked about how expensive my baseball cards are. People could break into my house and try and steal these baseball cards from me. They're worth $1 million. And he's just set me up to just look bad with these baseball cards. You guys would never do that. You guys are my friends. I don't even have any friends except for you guys. I just like hanging out with you guys. And it's like, Gerald, they're filming you admitting to crimes. What are you talking about?
These are shark-eyed streaming service documentarian filmmakers. Like, they would sell you down the river in a second if it meant the average time on site would go up by like 3 milliseconds. If your documentary could get like 1 million more downloads in a month, they would sacrifice their own babies on an altar.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see that
these people, some young unfortunate woman was murdered on a road trip with her boyfriend, and within days of her murder being confirmed, were already putting out podcasts about it. Like, they will drink your blood.
It's depressing to think about in those terms. But yeah, it's very, very depressing. So, you know, but that kind of covers the basics of just like what a surreally weird person he is and how he's kind of just lost in the forest of his own pervertity. It's so weird.
I was hanging out with my buddy Gay. We were trading locker room stories. Oh, you mean that clandestine meeting where you were admitting to me your years of crimes and I was writing it down as part of my article for the news, my expose on you? Yeah, and you know, that time when we were hanging out and just palling around and just trading stories, like, you know, war stories from our past. It's like, oh, I didn't tell you any stories. Like, yeah, you told me that whole story about how you are, you know, you went around all these places and you're writing these stories about things. Yeah, I told you I'm a journalist and I kind of gave you my background. And then I heard your horrible crimes and wrote them down and made a piece about them. And like I said, an expose about what a maniac you are. I thought we were just hanging. I thought we were friends.
So the New York article comes out and it's almost kind of like a trailer sort of for the full book. And people, well, they kind of lose their fucking mind, understandably. Like, they flip the fuck out.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of like the most carnal of fears that anybody could have. Like, mm-hmm. there are a handful of things that can trigger our fears and paranoias and anxieties as much as a story that's essentially like, hey, you know, anytime you've ever been out in staying in a hotel room or like in a dressing room at a store, there could have just been somebody watching you just behind the wall. And not only could there have been, but there definitely was, because this happened.
Yeah, this guy literally did that.
This one is just chilling. An Aurora motel owner watched his guests in some of the most intimate moments without them even knowing this. Now, this wasn't just once. It went on for decades, and it's all detailed in the New Yorker magazine. Denver 7 reporter Lance Hernandez is live in Aurora this afternoon. Lance, the hotel has been demolished, but the former owner is still alive.
Adam, the old Manor House Motel stood right here at the corner of Colfax and Scranton, across the street from the Anschutz Medical Campus. Now, in addition to all the sex that Gerald Foos claims he watched happen here, he said he saw a murder, but never told police.
Acclaimed writer Gay Talese said he received a note from Foos in 1980 saying he purchased the motel to satisfy his voyeuristic tendencies. Foos detailed how it took months to foolproof the ceiling vents to perfection. After installing them, he hovered above in the attic and asked his wife to lie on the bed below to see if she could see him through the louvers. If she could, he would adjust them. Now, Foos apparently began watching guests in 1966. The New Yorker magazine article says between Thanksgiving and January of his first year, Foos observed 46 sex acts. He kept notes. They were very polite, very organized couple with male companion, he said about one threesome, who apparently took pictures. When asked about an invasion of privacy, Foos reportedly replied, "There's no invasion of privacy if no one complains." Foos apparently considered what he was doing research. The article says that by the late 70s, Foos grew jaded about what he was seeing through the vents. He began writing about how he felt about himself and his infatuation as a young boy with his aunt.
Now, Foos told the author that he didn't want to come forward until after the statute of limitations had expired. He's not answering his phone. He lives up in Brighton, but he told our partners at the Denver Post that he couldn't really say anything because he's under contract. And by the way, I checked with Aurora police. They say they have no record of the homicide that Foos claims he witnessed here when the motel was here. Reporting live in Aurora, Lance Hernandez, Denver 7.
Why did they present that story with the tone of like, we're down here where a cat is stuck in a tree and the whole neighborhood's pitching in on trying to get it down? Like, why did it have that tone?
Welcome to Little Timmy's Lemonade Drive, where we are going to sell 25-cent cups on the site of horrific rape and murder charges.
He's just, these two just like square-jawed news anchors, just like, now today's kooky story at 5.
Local interest. Check it out.
Yeah, like, my God, like, it's not murder if the person doesn't see it coming.
What the fuck is that? What the fuck is that? In April of 2016, Steven Spielberg purchased the rights to create a film based on Foose's life, with director Sam Mendes tapped to direct. The film was canceled, though, in November of 2016, after Spielberg and Mendes learned of the upcoming documentary feature about the same subject.
We're really excited about this new project. You know, I've optioned the life story of Mr. Foose, and I'm gonna produce the film, and Sam Mendes is gonna direct it, and I'm really thinking of it as like the terminal in a hotel. we've cast Tom Hanks. He's gonna play Gerald Foose. Diego Luna is gonna play a young hapless hotel goer with his girlfriend, Zoe Saldana, and I'm really excited about it. Wait, what? They made a what?
They've been shooting a what? The motherfucker who optioned us this shit never thought to mention it to us?
He's playing all them back channels, baby. He's a voyeur of optioning. He's in the fucking shadows just being like, yeah, I optioned this shit. I'm going to come over here. I'm going to option this shit. You don't know about that, but you know about this. He's playing all sides. He's sneaking around in the Hollywood vents.
In regard to the decision to cancel the film, Mendes expressed frustration that no one had advised them of the documentary's existence, but said, "It has so many things that are wonderful and can only be achieved by a documentary. The story became infinitely more interesting and more complicated, but impossible to tell in a narrative movie." The New Yorker article was expanded into a book of the same name. Concerning the book, author and critic Michelle Dean wrote, "Shortly before the book appeared, the Washington Post, in an article by Paul Farhi, called Foose's veracity into question. The reporter pointed out that Foose hadn't owned the hotel for part of the time that he recorded the journals. Talese, confronted with this information, did nothing less than freak out. 'I'm not going to promote this book,' he told Farhi. 'How dare I promote it if the credibility is down the toilet?" So basically, they were like, a few months away from publication, and this Washington Post article came out where the Washington Post was like, "Hey, so you know that like Gerald Foose didn't own the Manor Hotel motel for like most of the time he says it, right? Like he says he sold it to his best friend in 1985, but he has all these journals about being there from like up until like 1995. Like that's like most of the time, right?" And Gay Talese was just like, "Fuck this, fuck Gerald Foose, fuck all of this. I've wasted 30 years of my life. I'm not doing this anymore.
I sold it to my best friend, Merrill Moose. Hey, oh, my name is Merrill Moose. I have a mustache and an eye patch. I just bought the hotel. Oh, so hey, Merrill. I'm sorry that I have to keep going off of the Zoom screen whenever you come on, but every time you come into the room, I have to take a piss. Oops, it's happening again. Oh, hey, it's me, Merrill Moose. I'm back again. And I just want to say that I'm the one that owned the motel for most of the time. I was the one up in those ceiling rafters jerking off. Also, I'm going to go to space and never be heard from again. See you later. Oh, look, Gerald's coming back from the bathroom. Oh, hey. Oh, my God. Merrill Moose left forever. He's gone. And none of his crimes can be prosecuted because he disappeared from this earth. Oh, well.
Yeah, it's just so bullshit. Because basically, like, he lied about owning it for that last 15 or 20 years or whatever. And then Gay Talese kind of goes, "Fuck this. I'm gonna disavow the book. It's not credible." And it was like a couple months before, you know, the book was released, and he just like sank the book basically. But there's another twist in this. However, Gay Talese discovered that the person who had owned the hotel for that period was still alive. He contacted him and reported that that person said that Gerald had a key and complete access to the observation platform for that entire period. Therefore, Gay Talese stated that he had overreacted. Gerald Fuss claimed that he had not brought this up because he didn't want to incorporate that other person's name into it and have it be connected to voyeurism. And so Gay Talese re-avowed the book.
Hey, this is Merrill Moose calling from space. I just figured right before I jump into this wormhole and disappear into another dimension, I should just call and clarify that Gerald did have a key and he was in the motel every single day up there jerking off along with me. All right, bye. Oh my God, aliens.
The Washington Post did an interview with you where they had found some inconsistencies in his story as far as the years he owned the hotel.
Yeah.
You even say in
this
the
is
book,
Gay Talese being interviewed on Late Night with Seth Meyers about this whole mix-up of like being avowed, being disavowing a book and then reavowing it.
To call you out for getting facts wrong.
Well, it might be self-serving the way I sound, but I'm not trying to be self-serving. The Washington Post is wrong. When I first got this news, I was broadside. And I'm 84 now, but most of my life, from the time I was 20, I was a very careful reporter. I'm still a careful reporter. And they said, the Washington Post said, that during a period, this guy this owned this motel for 37 years, for about 6 or 7, 8 years, from 1980, that's when after I left him, until about 86 or so, he didn't own the motel. Meaning, how can you not own the motel and try to write about as if you're in the motel? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that, and I was very upset, and I said, well, I can't go along and support this book. But the next day, I called the guy who bought the motel from the motel guy that I knew, and he said, no, I bought this motel from Gerald Fuss, the guy, but he still had access to it. He had the key, and he had the key all the way through the owners. Then he rebought the motel in 86. If I had known that day I was told about this Washington, what I know now or what I knew the next day, I wouldn't have disavowed the book. That was a mistake in my part, but I overreacted. I was very angry and very embarrassed too, because I took pride always in my life, reliable reporter. That's what I am. And I wasn't what the Post said, but I don't blame the aggressiveness of reporters in trying to check the facts, because we all try to do that.
Well, in fact, that's important. I want to ask as well, you wrote an article for Esquire called Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. It got reprinted a bunch this year because it would have been his 100th birthday. Right. It is considered a turning point piece of journalism. You spent time with the Sinatra camp and the Sinatra people. When you were working on this piece that sort of advented this new form of journalism, did you know it was going to be a piece that would live on as long as it has?
No. I've written so many pieces, and I never know what the public is going to like or remember. In my 65 years as a reporter, the only time I really enjoyed talking to someone, I know you don't have, you have a wonderful experience talking to everybody every night, and you love them all.
Yes.
I didn't love any of them, except Peter O'Toole.
Peter O'Toole.
And he affected my life. First of all, he'd done Lawrence of Arabia, and I went to London, where he lived, interview him, and he said, we have to go to Ireland. So he let me go with him to Ireland, and not that we drank all the time. We drank much of the time. But much of the time when we weren't drinking, so surprising, a superstar actor, great actor, he'd ask me about myself. And God, I'm the interviewer. No, he's interviewing me. And he said, are you married? I said, yes, I'm married in 1959, and I'm married to the same woman tonight, as of tonight. I think.
Yeah,
when I get home, I'm off the check. But anyway, he said, you have any children? I said, no, we've been married 4 years. My wife is also a Catholic family, an Irish Catholic family. And I said, no, I'm a reporter, I can't afford it. You can't afford it? No, I can't afford a child. You know, you're not a risk taker, are you? He said, I have a child, and I'm an actor. Well, I'm not a risk taker. I just didn't think I could afford it. Well, why don't you just change and do it? Why don't you just do it? Nike commercial, just try it, do it. And he said, why don't you have your wife come over and stay with us in London. My wife would be glad to have you as a guest. Stay. So I call my wife, Nan Talese. I said, hey, Peter O'Toole and his wife is Sean, she was an actress as well. Welcome us for a week. Nan flew over and we had this wonderful guest room. And during that 6-day period, as the guest of Peter and Sean Phillips was the wife and actress, we conceived our first child.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, Pamela was born in 64, 9 months after the Peter O'Toole invitation. And I think today he created my not being so much of afraid of not having enough money.
Well, that's why it breaks my heart.
Oh, my God. And then Peter O'Toole is up in the vents, looking down and just being like, "Oh, Gerald, this was a good idea, the right good idea. I'm glad you told me about this."
Yeah, it's interesting too, knowing that they had got married when he was like 19 or 20, whatever, because that also kind of makes sense on the thy neighbor's wife period of Gay Talese, you know? Like, I feel like this episode is kind of, it is equally about the observer and the observee, which is ironic because it's about Gerald Fuse and what a piece of shit he is. But it's also about Gay Talese and the type of person that would investigate that person and spend time with that person and really earn that person's trust. And also somebody who is very accomplished at knowing the back alleys of Hollywood and how to lie to Steven Spielberg to get him to option your book. Just not tell him that you've been making a fucking documentary for 2 years, you know? Like, we're just not going to mention that to Steven. It's not going to come up.
Yeah, it'll all work itself out. We'll make the movie, we'll make the documentary. You know, they do that all the time. There's like, there was that one year when there was those two magician movies that came out. There's like a year they put out like three Snow White movies in like the same week.
There was that thing where they made the Foxcatcher wrestling documentary, and then the same guy made the Foxcatcher fiction film.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We could put this documentary out and this movie out. We could put the Gerald Fuse documentary and Terminal
Motel.
Yeah. I was going to say Terminal Cancer, but yes.
No, it's Terminal 2 : Terminal Motel. Yeah.
We can totally do that.
Yeah. So that kind of brings us up till today. You know, the book came out. It was a moderate success. They optioned the film rights. It looked like they were going to make a movie. Then they canned the movie because the documentary came out. The documentary is available on Netflix. It's very interesting. It's very well made. But it's positioned as Gerald Fuse, shady fuckhead, and Gay Talese, literary journalist, where in reality, Gay Talese is just as shady.
Yeah, I mean, because he went and like looked at this thing and didn't tell somebody.
Yep. And also structured a film and TV deal off of it. Like, he's the one who was like, okay, we're going to make a documentary, we're going to make a film, we're going to make a New Yorker article, and I'm going to make a novel or a nonfiction book. We're going to do all of this at the same time. You know what it's like? It's like what the Warrens do with their in paranormal investigating stuff, where they hire writers to adapt their own stories into novels and then get those novels turned into films and TV projects.
Yeah, but it's worse though. I mean, fucking Ed Warren was like a pedophile who was doing something very terrible on the side, but in terms of their actual grift, like, this is worse because he is also a voyeur by the transitive property. He saw that this guy was doing this. He showed him that he had been doing it. He showed him how long he'd been doing it. And then he just left and just never said anything about it and wrote these articles about it and the books and eventually the documentary. And he's like on a press tour talking to Seth Meyers about it. It's like, you back in the 80s or the 90s or whatever it was, you went and saw him doing this and you were just like, well, better keep that in my back pocket.
I don't really know I don't know what the line there is. Like, what's the line for, I mean, I'm not condoning what Gay Talese did. I'm just, for the sake of discussion, like, what is the line of knowing that something is a story, but also knowing that it's not above board? Like, he also hung out with the Bonanno crime family for years.
Yeah, but that even that's like different. And like, even like what I was saying before about, you know, gonzo journalism and Hunter S. Thompson going and hanging out with the Hell's Angels and seeing them, you know, get into stabbings and all this stuff. And just any of these journalists that go into these like seedy underbellies and witness crimes and report on them or whatever. That's kind of one thing, because, you know, people know that the mafia has been largely kind of reformed, but people knew that the mafia was a thing. They knew that these people were doing these things. It was something that people had knowledge of. And he went into this world and witnessed these things that people are aware of. And if there was something that could be done about it, or that somebody, or if there was something that something, if there was something that could be done about it, or something that people wanted to do about it, they had the knowledge and the equipment to do something about it. Like, they could have stopped the Bonanno crime family if they wanted to, or if they could. There was clearly something holding them back, whether it was that they just didn't have the resources and manpower to crack down on a mob family, or maybe they just didn't want to because there was some corruption going on there. There was some reason for that. People were aware of the Hell's Angels. The cops knew about it. They knew what they were doing. They weren't stopping them for some reason.
I see what you're saying. You're saying that there's a difference between the fact that there is a criminal enterprise happening that people can't necessarily prove beyond a shadow of a doubt in courtrooms, but that other people are aware that that is happening, to this where it's literally just Gerald Foos, his wife, and our boy, Gigi Telsey. I don't know. I don't have a cute nickname for Gay Talese.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, he was the only person that knew. So he was like the sole person who could have gone and told somebody about it at that time and brought this thing to light as, you know, a crime.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating because you know that he would never have do that because it's a story, you know?
Yeah. But you're right that there is like some weird, there is like this gray area of where the line is, what the morality of that is. I mean, that was actually discussed recently whenever Bob Woodward put out his book on Trump recently. And there was a passage of it where he was talking about there's a kind of a revelation in the book of a quote from Trump in an interview saying that he kind of acknowledging that he knew he was spreading misinformation about the about election fraud, that he was kind of doing it because he's basically saying like, yeah, you know, I'm saying these things because it'll help me win if I say them, like kind of acknowledging that he knew it wasn't true and that he was purposely misleading people. He didn't say it that exactly, but he said something that was kind of like interpreted as that whenever the book came out. Yeah. And so there was like kind of like a backlash where it was like, you knew this and you had this quote from Donald Trump and you just waited until your book was published to show the world this revelation about the fact that Trump like admitted he was lying. And you know, and the response, like Woodward's response, is just like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm a journalist and I wrote this biography or this, I wrote this book about this thing, and the book came out when it came out and it had the information it had in it. And yeah, there is some kind of like, where's the line of that? Like, where is it? Like, where does it become your responsibility to like tell people about these things?
Because the delineating factor is that books, and specifically the way that traditional books are published, is that it takes about 2 years to get a book published. And the world, you know, 50 years ago, that was perfectly fine. You know, that was the pace that the world moved at. Now you can send a tweet that can be read on the other side of the world, literally the millisecond after you hit send. And so the world just moves at a very different pace. And that, I think, is the delineating factor, right? Of like, I don't have the answer of where that gray area ends and where it becomes a moral imperative, but that's the, you're reckoning with the old world way of doing things, which is the way that the levers of power have shored up the legitimate way to have a career and build a name for yourself and pay rent, with the way that social media has just devoured the entire world and now everything is free all the time. And everything is everywhere all the time. And we are all complicit in the destruction of the mechanisms that allow these benign entities to roll forward and theoretically disseminate knowledge in an institutionalized and protected way. Sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes that's a bad thing because institutions can become corrupt and rot. Sometimes that's a good thing because we need people to double check that Gerald Foos actually did own the fucking motel or whatever, you know?
Yeah, that's the other end of the, that's the other side of the coin where it's like people were freaking out about on Woodward about not putting this out. But it's like, you know, what if he had just impulsively tweeted that information and then like maybe he misheard him or maybe he lied and that wasn't the quote that he said, or, you know, it's worth verifying things and going through and being methodical about making sure that the thing that you're claiming is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, you know, is an interesting place to kind of put our summary thoughts in on this episode. I think for me, my kind of takeaway from this is, one, it's a fascinating human interest story. It's riveting to look at Gerald Foose and this bizarre fucked up ecosystem of his two wives, the motel, the people that have stayed there, the crimes that happened there. But it's also just profoundly sad. And I don't believe for a second that Gerald Foose did all of this because he saw his aunt naked when he was 10. Like, there's so much more fucked up shit going on inside that person. And I'm not even necessarily convinced that the aspects of the story that, you know, are more outlandish even really happened in the way that he says they happened. That murder was never substantiated. No one ever definitively proved that it happened there. You know, I'm the fact that the dates are wrong by 3 years, the fact that Gerald Foose just seems like a weird God complex dude who has this inflated sense of moral piety. It's just very strange. Like, everything about it is strange, and that's why it's compelling, but that's also why I don't necessarily believe all of it. But it's a very interesting kind of thought exercise of, like, how do we treat these types of people? Because he's definitely not the only person who's ever done this. Like, there's, you know, celebrities who've... Was it Little Richard who filmed women in bathrooms?
Don't,
no, who was that?
We've already had this conversation. You've already tried to spread this misinformation on the show before,
real?
Dave.
I don't remember. Was that...
No, it was...
Wrong?
It's so funny because... You said this exact same thing on a,
on
a previous
episode.
God damn
it. I'm sorry.
No, it was not Little Richard. It was Chuck Berry who had cameras inside of a bathroom in a restaurant that he owned.
Right. I'm sorry. I apologize to the state of Little Richard.
Don't you besmirch Little Richard's name. Angel who, because of some kind of self-hatred, condemned homosexuality and was a big part of, like, pushing this narrative that being gay is a sin, but otherwise a perfect angel. I'm joking about that. Of course, that's a really fucked up thing, and it's a huge problematic mark on his legacy.
Copy that. I apologize. I'm not as big a Little Richard fan as you, and I apparently have forgotten that it was not him and it was Chuck Berry. This is the second time. I'm sorry.
Yes.
But, like, you know, there's been cases of people doing stuff like this before. So it's obviously something that humans like and are fascinated by.
And also, low key, our culture, like, condones it. Like, there's a whole fucking film series that's just about how zany the hijinks of surveilling women without their knowledge is.
Yeah.
The Porky's movies and even the Revenge of the Nerds movies. Like, they have they put the cameras inside of the Omega, or no, they put the cameras inside of the female version of a fraternity called?
Sorority.
Sorority. Yes. They put the cameras inside of the sorority, and then they're watching them on their TV in their frat house. Like, it's just like they're just sitting there on the couch watching it. And that's just like, these zany kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just find it incredible. I just, the thing that's most surreal to me about it is just the lack of separation between the story and its cultural existence and the guy. Like, the fact that he's just walking around, just being like, yeah, I was in that roof jerking off to those people. I saw a murder. Where's your bathroom, Mr. Netflix? Like that's just so fucking surreal to me that he's just, like, walking around just like a normal dude, openly admitting to these things. And just, like, everyone's just like, yeah, there's that guy. He's here. He's a figure. That's just so surreal to me.
I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Andrew Price.
This has been Deep Cuts. If you'd like to find me on the internet, you can do so at xDaveBakerX on TikTok, Twitter, and Instagram, or at heydavebaker.com, where you can find my books, Everyone is Tulip, Action Hospital, Fuck Off Squad, Night Hunters, all kinds of good stuff. Andrew Price, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me in the...
Don't. don't.
Like, this template for how I do my outros, like, this is the perfect setup for it. Like, what do you expect me to do?
All right, fine, do it.
No, I'm gonna subvert it. You can find me in a hotel room, just covered in the writhing flesh of just a swinging coke-filled 80s orgy. And being the only one in the room, because of my particular attentiveness and observation skills that a lot of other people don't have, noticing that I feel like there's a little bit of a weird sound coming from the ceiling. What is that? It's probably nothing. We gon' fuck. And you can also find me at daprycewrites.com, where you get my book, Deadbolt AI Private Eye. You can also get some Deep Cuts merch if you go to our shop. Just go to deepcutspod.com, click on the shop, or you can go to bit.ly/deepcutsmerch. Check out our shirts, our hats with cool Deep Cuts graphics on them. You can get our mystery treehouse junior sleuth patch by going to deepcutspod.com. It's on the front page. You too can be a junior sleuth. You can join us in our Facebook group. Just search the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group. We talk about the episodes. We talk about other cool stuff. Meme chefs post their memes. It's a cool little community where we talk about the show and other things. You can also join our Discord server. You can go to bit.ly/deepcutsdiscord. It's another cool community where we talk about episodes. We talk about movies, TV shows, music. People post memes there. There's a lot more kind of like specific channels to talk about all kinds of crazy stuff. Follow us on Facebook or Instagram, Deep Cuts Podcast or Deep Cuts Pod. Deep Cuts is a production by Boy Genius Media. If you'd like to find this show and others like it, please visit boygeniusmedia.com or deepcutspod.com.
If you want to join in on post-episode discussions, please join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group. Finally, subscribe to our YouTube channel for additional video content.